Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Land of War, a history of European warfare from Achilles to Putin, by William Nestor, narrated by David Colacci. Introduction. War is a continuation of political commerce by other means. Karl von Clausewitz. War is just when it is necessary. Niccolò Machiavelli. War made the state, and the state made war. Charles Tilly. We have made Italy, now we must make Italians. Massimo D'Azeglio. How could Europeans escape from the pattern of their history? How could nations suddenly learn to behave like civilized men? Jean Monnet. War is as old as the first bloody clash between hunter-gatherer bands over a waterhole or edible carcass. Wars are fought by groups of men, recently joined by women, organized to kill each other on land, on water, and since World War I, in the air. Recently, a new type of warfare emerged that is fought virtually online in cyberspace. Why do people go to war against each other, whether they are organized in bands, tribes, city-states, nation-states, or empires? No two wars are alike. Superficial similarities among wars obscure profound differences in why and how those involved did what they did. Every war is unique, with its own complex reasons for why it started, how it was fought, who won, and what happened after it ended. Karl von Clausewitz found something that all wars share. The war of a community always starts from a political condition and is called forth by a political motive. War is a continuation of political commerce by other means. War is political because it involves conflicts between groups, with each using power to get what it wants. Military power includes both hard or physical power, like weapons, soldiers, rations, and transport, and soft or psychological power, like strategy, heroism, leadership, and morale. War, however, is as rare as politics is incessant, because war's human, financial, and moral costs are so great, while the results are usually so uncertain. Groups in conflict usually find nonviolent means either to keep what they have that the other wants, or to take what the other wants to keep. War in Europe began with the first human migrants. For tens of thousands of years, bands that encountered each other braced themselves to fight, flee, talk, or trade. Before the nuclear age, warfare was never more existential. A war party could ambush a band, slaughter its men, and seize its women, children, and goods. With time, bands allied with each other to form tribes that traded freely among their members and either warred or traded with rival tribes. A series of technological breakthroughs revolutionized how people fed, organized, and fought. The domestication of first animals and then plants gave people a steady food supply in one place. Populations expanded with the nutrition. The communalism of hunter-gatherer bands gave way to stratified, labor-based classes, in which most people nurtured animals or crops, artisans made desired things, merchants exchanged those things, warriors kept order within society and protected it from enemies, priests conducted religious rituals, and rulers governed. As for warfare, the first weapons were sticks and stones. That person who invented the spear or bow and arrow revolutionized warfare. Ancient geniuses developed metallurgy and produced first bronze, then iron, and finally steel tools, including armor and edged weapons. Men killed each other with metal swords, spears, and arrowheads for several thousand years. Then, in the 14th century, the first crude handguns and cannons appeared, which over several hundred years improved to surpass and eventually replace edged weapons for killing. 19th and early 20th century inventions like machine-made goods, railroads, steamships, telegraphs, telephones, machine guns, tractors, automobiles, trucks, airplanes, and tanks empowered states to muster, equip, arm, transport, and command ever more men with ever more firepower. During World War II, mastery of splitting the atom created bombs so powerful that one could destroy a vast city. During the 1990s, the United States led a revolution in military affairs, RMA, grounded on microelectronics that made weapons more accurate, cut through the fog of war to provide real-time intelligence about the enemy, and made it easier for units and troops within units to communicate and coordinate their tactics. The global Internet lets governments and groups spy on and war against each other with information extracted, disinformation planted, and damage inflicted, often without leaving a trace of just who did what. Historically, warfare in Europe began when the ancient Greeks and Romans began writing about it. Since then, Europe's center of political, military, and cultural gravity has shifted. Arguably, Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem prevailed during the ancient world, Rome and Constantinople during the Middle Ages, Florence, Venice, and Milan during the Renaissance, Rome, Madrid, Vienna, and Antwerp during the Reformation, Paris and London from 1650 to 1870, London, Berlin, and Paris from 1870 to 1918, Washington and New York from 1918 to 1929, London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, and Tokyo from 1929 to 1941, Washington and New York from 1942 to 1949, Washington, New York, London, Brussels, and Moscow from 1950 to 1990, Washington, New York, Brussels, London, and Berlin from 1990 to 2016, Brussels, Paris, and Berlin from 2016 through 2022, and Washington, Brussels, Paris, Berlin, Moscow, and Beijing from then through today. Among history's joys is that everything about it is more or less debatable. History is best known through its leaders. A leader is deemed great as far as he or she changes history for better or worse. So who is a greater statesman, Churchill or de Gaulle, Talleyrand or Metternich? Or who is a greater general, Alexander or Caesar, Marlborough or Eugene, Napoleon or Wellington? Arguably, no one influenced history more than religious leaders. Who was greatest, Moses, Jesus, Mohammed, or Luther? Of history's best-known female monarchs, Elizabeth of England and Catherine of Russia enhanced their realms, while Cleopatra of Egypt lost hers. How much did each have to do with that? Imagining alternatives can illuminate what prevailed. How would history read had Lenin or Hitler died at birth? Just as few leaders can be deemed great, few battles were decisive. Which was more so, Arbela or Alesia, Austerlitz or Waterloo, the Armada or Trafalgar, Stalingrad or Normandy? War has had a profound impact on the development of Europe's states and relations among them over time. No one put it more succinctly than historian Charles Tilly. War made the state, and the state made war. One might add that war made the nation, and the nation made war. Of course, both aphorisms are simplistic. War is as old as humanity, while modern states and nations began developing just a few centuries ago. Just when did nations make war, and war make nations? The Dutch revolt against the Habsburg Empire might be a good start, followed by the American revolt against the British Empire, and then the French revolutionary struggle against the counter-revolutionary states. We have made Italy, now we must make Italians. That famed insight was the title of Prime Minister Massimo D'Azeglio's memoir. D'Azeglio was among those who struggled to unify Italy. When he died in 1866, Italy was unified as a state, but not as a nation. Nation-building is much more complex than state-building because human identities are far more complex and deeper-rooted than administrative units. Although Europe's system was never closed, European states dominated it before the 20th century. The Persian Empire tried and failed to conquer the Greek city-states during the 5th century BCE. The Europeans faced a Muslim threat spearheaded by Arabs from the 7th to the 12th century and by Turks from the 12th to the 18th century. The fighting was chronic in the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslim invasion in 711 to the surrender of Granada, the last Muslim fortress, in 1492. The Turks conquered the Byzantine Empire with Constantinople's capture in 1453. Then they overran much of southeastern Europe and even besieged Vienna in 1529 and 1683. But no non-European power ever dominated, let alone conquered, Europe. Indeed, from the 15th century, European states began conquering and colonizing people beyond the continent to the ends of the earth. Among many forces, an edge in guns, germs, and steel decisively empowered them to do that. By 1914, Europeans had colonized all of South and North America, Australia, and Oceania, and nearly all of Africa and Asia, although the American colonies had won their independence. As European states competed and at times fought to extend or retain their overseas empires, they at once became more nationalistic and European. Confronting, conquering, and colonizing alien cultures and races reinforced European identity. They saw their religion, humanism, art, literature, and entire way of life as superior to those of barbarian peoples. They justified their imperialism as bringing Christianity and enlightenment to their subjects. George Canning famously boasted in 1823 that, "I called the New World into existence to redress the balance of the old." He was referring to Britain's policy of encouraging the Latin American states to win independence from Spain's empire. Actually, Britain's role in that conflict was at best peripheral. French King Louis XVI did not, but could have, uttered the same boast in 1783, with ample cause to do so. The United States won independence, when and how it did, because France provided crucial amounts of treasure, arms, troops, and warships. Eventually, the United States repaid that debt. Thrice in the 20th century, Americans saved Europeans from themselves. First through the follies that led to World War I, then the fascism that led to World War II, and finally the communism that led to the Cold War. Most Europeans regarded America's intervention and leadership with mingled relief, gratitude, and resentment. If European warfare is as old as the first prehistoric humans, the idea of Europe is much more recent. Historically, Europe has been a core value and an ill-defined shifting territory with increasingly diverse peoples who traded and fought each other over thousands of years. For historian A.J. P. Taylor, Europe is a relative notion. European history is whatever the historian wants it to be. It is a summary of the events and ideas, political, religious, military, pacific, serious, romantic, near at hand, far away, tragic, comic, significant, meaningless, anything else you would like it to be. There is only one limiting factor. It must take place in or derive from the area we call Europe. But as I am not sure exactly what that area is meant to be, I am well in a haze about the rest. Mythically, Europe began with a rape. Europa was a beautiful Sidon princess with whom Zeus was infatuated. To woo her, he first had her dream of two continents, Asia, in which she lived, and an unnamed, intriguing continent westward, each personified by a seductive woman. The next morning, Zeus disguised himself as a friendly bull and nuzzled up to Europa as she strolled on the beach. Enchanted, Europa bedecked the bull with flowers and finally climbed on his back. With that, Zeus plunged into the sea and swam away to Crete, where he had his way with her. For historian Norman Davies, that story represents how the ancient Greeks acquired higher civilization from more sophisticated societies eastward, while using Europe as the name of their territory to the west of the Aegean, as distinct from the older lands in Asia Minor. Europa gave birth to Minos, who became Crete's king. Minos had an underground labyrinth constructed, placed the Minotaur, a monster half-bull and half-human, in the center, and fed him with youths captured from Crete's conquests. Theseus of Athens went to Crete, entered the labyrinth with the aid of Ariadne, slew the Minotaur, and then returned triumphantly to Athens, where he was crowned king. That story can symbolize how Athens surpassed Crete as a political and cultural power, and in so doing, liberated people from Crete's tyranny with its own enlightened values and institutions. Although Europe is called a continent, that is misleading. Eurasia is the continental landmass that stretches nearly a third of the way around the world between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Contemporary Europe is clearly bound by the Mediterranean Sea, the Atlantic Ocean, and the Arctic Ocean, but its eastern border will always remain amorphous, with culture and politics more important than geography. Regardless, with seawater crashing ashore on three sides, Europe is perhaps the world's largest peninsula. As a source of identity, European is as hazy as the territory. One's identity develops partly against different, often threatening, other identities. The ancient Greeks and Romans contrasted themselves with the barbarian tribes northward and Sybaritic despotisms eastward. No ancient thinker promoted the notion of Europe more than Strabo, with his Geography, published in 10 CE. He benefited from the Roman Empire's unity to learn not only an extraordinary amount about its diverse cultures and states, but also of foreign civilizations. During the Middle Ages, religion was critical in developing a Christian and European identity at odds with pagans, Jews, and Muslims within and beyond. The Muslim conquests of the Middle East and North Africa, and for centuries most of the Iberian Peninsula and Balkans, eliminated European civilization as embracing the Mediterranean basin and instead confined it to territory north of those waters. Maps can reveal how people's identities can transform with time. Europe's medieval world maps display Jerusalem as central, with other known continents as appendages. From the mid-15th century, that worldview changed due to the European voyages of discovery, trade, and conquest around the world that brought back exotic goods, stories, and captives. The emphasis now was on different races, like Africans, South Asians, East Asians, and American Indians, with starkly different advanced civilizations or primitive cultures. Starting with Martin Waldensee Muller's 1511 map, Europe was central. Gerardus Mercator's 1554 map tried to account for the Earth's curve in depicting Europe. These new images changed how people saw themselves. Evermore, Europeans thought of themselves as such. For instance, astronomer Johannes Muller described Nuremberg as in the middle of Europe in 1471. In 1554, Flemish diplomat Ogier Gieselin stood in Constantinople, looked across the strait, and thought not that he was in the Muslim Ottoman Empire's capital, but instead that he was in Europe, and beyond was Asia. In his 1623 book, The Advancement of Learning, Francis Bacon used the phrase, "We Europeans." During the 16th century and early 17th century, a series of historians wrote books on Europe. including Ludovico Guicciardini's 1565 commentary on the most notable events in Europe, Pierre Giambullari's 1566 History of Europe, Alfonso Ulloa's 1570 History of Europe, Paolo Jovio's 1552 History of His Times, and Jacques-Auguste de Thou's 1620 A History of His Own Times. Europe is much better understood as an idea than a place. Humanism, enlightened individualism, is Europe's core value. The assumption is that everyone is born a unique bundle of potentialities, most good, some bad. Our moral duty is to nurture the best in ourselves and others, and to sublimate the worst into something better. And that is not just a social effort, but ultimately cultural and political. Before the modern era, humanism was confined to rare clusters of individuals with enough wealth, power, and desire to realize and perpetuate its ideals. Humanism was born in the Eastern Mediterranean basin as a dynamic matrix among Greco-Roman and Judeo-Christian values. Mythologically, Odysseus and Eve were the first humanist man and woman. For knowledge and freedom, Eve dared to defy God, while Odysseus defied the gods. But in the ancient world, no realm realized humanism more than Republican Athens. Will Durant explained the dynamic whereby Greek humanism passed through countless minds and cultures to us today. Civilization does not die, it migrates. It changes its habitat and its dress, but it lives on. The decay of one civilization, as of one individual, makes room for the growth of another. Greek civilization is alive. It moves in every breath of mind that we breathe. So much of it remains that none of us in one lifetime could absorb it all. We think of Greece as the bright morning of that Western civilization which, with all its kindred faults, is our nourishment and our life. When Rome devoured Greece in the 2nd century before Christ, humanism was the most nutritious spoil. Humanism spread with the Roman Empire, although few exemplified its ideals, most notably Cicero, Caesar, and Marcus Aurelius. Over time, Judeo-Christian humanist values mingled with the Greco-Roman ones, especially after Constantine legalized Christianity in 313 and Theodosius made it the empire's faith in 380. Humanism mostly gestated during the medieval millennium from the last Roman emperor in 476 to Gutenberg's Bible in 1450, kept alive in a few brilliant courts like those of Charlemagne, Frederick II, and Eleanor of Aquitaine, and by anonymous monks reveling in the wisdom and beauty of the manuscripts they copied. Although Christianity was split between Catholicism and Latin westward and Orthodoxy and Greek eastward, their estrangement rarely turned violent, as each warred against neighboring Muslim states. During the Renaissance, worldly Europeans understood themselves as sharing humanism, history, territory, Christianity, and enemies. Then the Reformation divided Europe between Catholic and Protestant states that fought a series of wars against each other for more than a century through 1648. The idea of Europe as a unified political and economic system is relatively recent. In the 18th century, political philosopher Charles-Louis de Secondat, Baron de Montesquieu, saw more unity than diversity across the continent. The state of things in Europe is that all the states depend on each other. Europe is a single state composed of several provinces. François Arouet Voltaire also viewed Europe as a kind of great republic divided into several states, with the same principle of public law and politics, unknown in other parts of the world. Amid the Seven Years' War, international law theorist Emmerich de Vattel called for a peace designed to make modern Europe a sort of republic whose members, each independent but all bound together by common interest, unite for the maintenance of order and the preservation of liberty. Immanuel Kant's 1795 essay, Perpetual Peace, advocated a Europe of republics united by trade and a federation that kept peace among them. Giuseppe Mazzini began as an Italian nationalist with the Young Italy movement he founded in 1831, but from 1834 championed a Young Europe movement dedicated to peace and humanism. A series of peace conferences illuminated the notion of Europe with a common culture, law, and interests, including Westphalia from 1643 to 1648, Utrecht from 1713 to 1715, and Vienna from 1814 to 1815. No one contributed more to a European legal system than Hugo Grotius, with his On the Law of War and Peace, published in 1625. However, those legal concepts and the subsequent international treaties and laws that they inspired did nothing to prevent wars or mitigate their death and destruction. Indeed, war's scale and carnage rose steadily through the modern era. The horrors of the First and Second World Wars made unity an imperative rather than a sentiment for ever more prominent people on either side of the Atlantic. Jean Monnet lamented how tragically war had straitjacketed Europe's history. How could Europeans escape from the pattern of their history? How could nations suddenly learn to behave like civilized men? The answer was an increasingly integrated European economic and political system, starting with the Organization of European Economic Cooperation, OEEC, from 1948, the European Coal and Steel Community, ECSC, from 1951, the European Economic Community, EEC, from 1957, and the European Union, EU, from 1993. Those international organizations that promoted European interdependence, along with others like the United Nations, UN, from 1945, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, from 1949, have made war among European state members unthinkable. Thus did European identity and institutions develop in opposition to the wars that had plagued Europeans throughout their history and prehistory. Those extraordinary achievements liberated Europeans from wars among themselves, but not from others. Jihadist groups will keep committing terrorist attacks across Europe. Millions of desperate refugees from wars and failed states in the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere will keep trying to migrate to Europe. Through his wars against Ukraine, cyber warfare, and other means, Russian President Vladimir Putin will keep trying to break up Europe and transform its liberal democracies into illiberal democracies beholden to Moscow rather than Brussels and Washington. His 2022 war against Ukraine actually promoted greater European and transatlantic unity. Nonetheless, Russian and other threats will worsen in the coming decades as global warming devastates ever more regions already locked in vicious cycles of political, economic, social, and ecological deterioration, and will eventually engulf Europe itself. Will Europe's institutions continue to uphold peace, prosperity, law, and unity? Or will they collapse to loose war again among Europeans? Land of War, a history of European warfare from Achilles to Putin, is an epic odyssey through time from the civilization's mythic origins to its latest violent conflicts. Along the way, you will encounter some of the best and worst statesmen and generals, the most decisive wars and battles, and the underlying dynamic array of political, economic, technological, social, cultural, and psychological forces that determined them. 1. Greeks and Romans. The famous spearman struck behind his skull just at the neck cord, the razor spear slicing straight up through the jaws, cutting away the tongue. He sank in the dust, teeth clenching the cold bronze. Homer's Iliad.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?